From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with journalist and screenwriter Dan Wakefield. His new book, Returning, A Spiritual Journey, describes his encounters with alcoholism, agnosticism, psychoanalysis, and his rediscovery of religion. Independent record producer Oren Keepnews believes his job is to act as a catalyst and bring out an artist's creativity. His flexibility in the studio made him a popular producer with some of the greatest modern jazz musicians. Coming up, he talks about his long collaboration with the late Thelonious Monk. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles Louis Jordan, the man who spearheaded the rhythm and blues sound, and book critic John Leonard reviews The Fifth Child, the new novel by Doris Lessing. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Dan Wakefield is a best-selling novelist and screenwriter whose new memoir begins like this. One balmy spring morning in Hollywood, a month or so before my 48th birthday, I woke up screaming. It was the beginning of a year in which I would have scored in the upper percentile of these popular magazine tests that list the greatest stresses of life. I left the house I owned, the city I was living in, the work I was doing, the woman I had lived with for 7 years, ran out of money, and discovered I had endangered my health. Wakefield's doctors recommended giving up alcohol and taking up exercise. He followed their advice. This personal crisis then led him to return to his former home, Boston, and to return to the church. As a young man, Wakefield had become an agnostic, but the religion he sought and found as an adult was different from the encounters that earlier had led him away from the church. Dan Wakefield's new memoir is titled Returning, A Spiritual Journey. His novels include Going All the Way and Starting Over, which was adapted into a hit film which starred Jill Clayburgh and Burt Reynolds. He created the short-lived TV series James at 15 and is a former contributing editor of The Atlantic magazine. Dan Wakefield, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me take a guess here. I would guess that when you started to write this book, one of the first things you had to contend with was how making this real crisis in your life come off as real as you felt it and not sound like a midlife crisis in a made-for-TV movie or something. It's the most horrifying thing when you're going through the biggest crisis of your life and you say to myself, my God, if I tell someone like this, will it sound as real as I feel it, or will it sound like a cliche?
I was very lucky because the way that I originally wrote it was not thinking I'm writing a book or not thinking I'm writing this for a big audience. I wrote it for 8 people in a class on spiritual autobiography in the church I was going to. And that really was fabulous because I felt no constraints. I felt no need to either be apologetic or to hide anything. I just wrote, and it was such a wonderful feeling. And that's the piece I then sent to the New York Times Magazine, and they put it in word for word. I didn't even know they would take such a thing. And in fact, I was kind of asking for advice. Where could I publish a thing like this? And the next thing I knew, they were doing it.
Yeah, the idea of a spiritual autobiography was new to me from reading your book. Mm. Explain what the concept is.
Well, the concept is, I would, for instance, take probably the classic spiritual autobiography, well, at least after St. Augustine, would be Thomas Merton, The Seven-Story Mountain. I taught a course in spiritual autobiography that I kind of made up last year, in which I used Merton and Paul Cowan's book on returning to Judaism and Peter Matheson's book on Zen, his Zen journals. So it's, in my terms, a spiritual autobiography is anybody looking at their life through a spiritual lens or through that prism of experience.
And that's exactly what you've done in your memoir. So there's big parts of your life that are missing.
Right.
But all the things that pertain to the leaving and the coming to.
Yeah, and also there's a lot of my life that people usually don't think of as spiritual. And I mean, I talk frankly about a lot of things that in fact have upset some people reading and say, oh, well, what are you talking about, sex? That has anything to do with spirituality. And I'm trying to see experience through a spiritual lens.
So, in that quote that I read from your book at the beginning, we got some idea of some of the big kind of calamitous things that happened to you the year that you decided to leave Los Angeles. But how was your career going, too, and what kind of stresses was being in Hollywood giving to you?
Oh, it was huge stress. In fact, when I went to that doctor out there, and I just went to an MD, and I said, I have this funny feeling my heart is beating too fast. And he took my pulse and said, well, you're right. Your pulse is 120. Took an EKG, said, well, there's nothing wrong with your heart. yet. Tell me, are you in the entertainment business? And I said, why, yes, I write for television. He says, oh, well, that explains it. And then he just wrote out a prescription. He said, so to answer your question, yes, that had a lot to do with it. And I felt terrible about the. I felt I was in this syndrome of a downward spiral from having a series on the air, James at 15, which did last for a whole year, and it was a great kind of thrill for a writer of novels to have a TV series that I liked, and I loved the show and the characters and the people, and then from that to be suddenly nothing was working, nothing was happening. And I was scared. I was frightened.
I think, you know, what seemed to me was your last straw was when, I think it was a plumber came in to fix something, and, and even he had an idea for a made-for-TV movie. There were just deals being made wherever you turned.
That's right, yeah. The plumber saw the typewriter, and he said, you know, I've always had a great idea for a series about a plumber who goes into people's houses and he actually finds out where the jewels are and stuff. He said, do you want to do it? And I didn't know whether he meant, like, as a pilot or a real operation, so...
You know, it interested me that the first step you took is that you went to see your medical doctor.
Right.
Because I think whenever any of us are feeling in these incredible crisis-like periods and it manifests itself in some kind of physical symptom, you don't know where to turn first, you know?
Yeah.
Should you see a psychiatrist or go to a doctor or maybe just take a day off or, you know, get religious again, you know?
I'm
you started
really
with
glad,
the medical doctor.
I'm really glad I did that because I had never done that in my life. And I think some real deep instinct told me that this
take care of that
finally
first.
Do that. And in fact, another deep instinct told me, gee, taking a prescription just didn't quite the answer to this. And so I went back to Boston. My doctor there did all the same tests. And instead of saying take a prescription, said, I want you to go to this stress clinic, do the exercise, lose some weight, and try to get in shape. And that was just shocking to me because I had never done that since Boy Scout camp. And that really, I think that whole physical turnaround led to some kind of spiritual awareness. Without it, I don't think it would have happened.
My guest is Dan Wakefield, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, Returning, A Spiritual Journey, which is a spiritual autobiography. Now, it was when you went back to Boston to move there again, to see your old doctor there as well, that you started going back to church again. How did
right.
that come up?
It came out of the blue, almost. I was feeling a lot better because I got into this exercise program. I lost 20 pounds.
You gave up alcohol.
I gave up drinking, which I didn't think was possible for me to do. So I was clear. I had achieved a state of clarity that I hadn't had for a long, long time. And in that condition, I was, in fact, I was in a bar in my neighborhood. I was just having a cup of coffee and hearing the guys talk. And this man said, oh, I think I might like to go to church on Christmas Eve. And it just struck me. It was one of those thoughts that just took hold. And I decided to go to King's Chapel because I knew the minister from the neighborhood and it didn't look threatening and it said it was just going to be Christmas carols. And what I didn't know was that interspersed in the carols, he read a few things and he happened to read that night a passage from a fabulous novel by Evelyn Waugh called Helena about the mother of Constantine. And the passage he read was about the late comers to the church. And I felt singled out personally. And I was very moved by it. And then I went home and was in bed with the flu for 4 days and a high temperature. And I thought, well, if this is what happens from going to church, I got to be careful. And the whole thing, it was difficult going back in the sense that I hadn't done it for 25 years. I had all kind of emotions about it. Also, being in intellectual Boston, I was a little bit afraid to be seen crossing the common on Sunday morning with a suit and tie. And I must say, to my amazement, I found there were other people in the church who I knew, the regular, respectable
closet
people.
Churchgoers.
That's right. So it wasn't so threatening in that sense once I got into the rhythm.
Well, you wrote that you really got to like the idea of church as sanctuary.
Yes. Yeah, I really felt that. And I think that, and also church as sanctuary. And
sanctuary from what?
From the assaults of daily life that I think we all are subject to, you know, whatever's happening, whether the house is falling apart or your business or your bank account or whatever, that here's a place that you're, for a little while, out of that realm that you're in a realm where that particular kind of battle is not going to take place. And just for just a space of silence or a space of music and silence and thought or prayer or meditation on something beyond all that conflict.
Now, you had mentioned that it was 25 years since you had been to church. You had been a churchgoer when you were young. Your family
yes.
was Presbyterian.
Yes.
And then you kind of left church when you went to New York to go to Columbia University.
Right.
What were some of the things about religion, the way you knew it as a child, that turned you off when you became an adult?
Well, what really turned me off when I became an adult was that was in the 1950s when I was at Columbia, and at that time the popular Protestant religion of the day was kind of embodied by Norman Vincent Peale and positive thinking, and I sort of felt, well, this is like religion made easy and religion sanitized and Americanized for country club goers, and I was in my first discovery of intellectual truth and wonder and really delight, and that was just jarring to me. Seemed very phony. And of course, what I put aside were all the things like, in fact, Thomas Merton, who had gone to Columbia, and I didn't want to know about that. I didn't want to know that there were intellectuals and men of great sensitivity and women of great sensitivity who did have spiritual feelings and thoughts and insights in their lives.
Because you just wanted to make a break.
I just want to make a break. I want to say that's all bad. Now I'm searching for truth, which is all in this other area and has nothing to do with that.
Your mother had for a while been in something called the moral rearmament movement?
Oh, yes. Yes,
well,
that
was
another phenomenon of the 50s. I think it still goes on, but it was started in England and it came here, and it was encounter-like group, and it to me seemed to fit in with the Norman Vincent Peale stuff, and also was very repressive, very, talking about the evils of sin and sexuality, and so it fit in with that whole thing I was really trying to escape from.
So as an adult, when you returned to the church, did you feel right away that you were able to find a way of expressing your spiritual beliefs and of being in a church community without going back to the kind of repressiveness
oh, yeah.
that you
sure.
were just mentioning?
Yeah, I didn't feel that kind of thing at all. And I feel so lucky that I happened to walk into this particular church. And, it's really funny. We've had retreats at this Benedictine monastery near Boston called Glastonbury Abbey. And one of the brothers there after our last retreat said, Dan, you're so lucky to be in King's Chapel. It's such a nice group of people. We always enjoy having them out. And it suddenly came, I said, yeah, I never thought of it this way, but I feel like the line from Casablanca, of all the gin joints in all the world, and I walked into this one. But it was a stroke of good fortune.
It strikes me that some listeners might be thinking, well, when are they going to get to the part where he tells everybody that they should join his religion? You know what I mean? Because
right.
it's become, I think, in a way, very difficult to talk about religion without people assuming. And then either they kind of pass
right.
the hat, so to speak,
right.
for money, or and then they try to convince me to join up.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's become a real problem.
It has. I mean, it makes you, it's among the many things that have given religion a bad name, and I'm not a recruiter, and I'm not trying to sell a program to anybody else, but just to describe my spirituality is not, it feels very much in tune with friends of mine of other faiths. I felt very much in tune with Matheson's book on Zen and with Paul Cowan's book on Judaism. My friend Sarah Davidson, who's a wonderful writer in Los Angeles, has really, by going to Israel 5 or 6 years ago, and where she went to just go camping on Mount Sinai and ended up having a real spiritual insight and rejuvenation, and has carried that into her life. And so many friends of different faiths are on this kind of path, which I find fascinating and delightful, that it's not restrictive.
Well, it is fascinating in a way that so many people are returning to a faith of one sort or another, and frequently
right.
to the faith that they were born into,
right.
as opposed to, say, in the late 60s when a lot of people were returning to somebody else's faith, to faiths from other parts of the country or to brand new religions. So a lot of people are still doing that as well, but I think more so than before, there are people who are kind of rethinking the faith that they were born into.
Exactly.
Do you have any big sociological reasons to suggest why this is happening?
Well, it's interesting. I've been writing a piece recently on the theologian Harvey Cox, and one of the reasons I got to writing the piece, he gives a course at Harvard called Jesus and the Moral Life, which has become the most popular course at Harvard, and last year had 1,000 students in it. And I was asking him about this. Well, why now? And he, of course, wrote a book called Turning East about the phenomenon of the 60s that you were just talking about. He said, well, I think for one thing that students found out and young people found out that Zen isn't easy, and that, which we always thought, you know, you could just get cracked over the head once with a bamboo stick and it would all be done for you. But finding out that, suddenly seeing, well, also, how does that apply if we're really Americans? You know, how does that apply to the lives we lead now? So people have felt more comfortable and more interested looking in their own roots as to how it can work in their own decisions today.
I think in a way, too, that maybe some people have found in their own religions things similar to what interested them in other religions.
Right, you know, that, exactly. That, and because they're not now getting the little Sunday school version of it, which smoothed everything over and said, oh, it's all just tiptoeing through the spiritual tulips.
Well, I want to talk with you more about things you discuss in your spiritual autobiography. My guest is Dan Wakefield, and he's written a memoir titled Returning, A Spiritual Journey. He's also the author of a few best-selling novels, including Starting Over, which was made into the hit film that starred Burt Reynolds and Jill Clayburgh. And we'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer Dan Wakefield is my guest, author of the new memoir, Returning, A Spiritual Journey. You know, in your early years, in going through your memoir and looking at how religion affected your life, the two really kind of like very personal issues that seem to be very connected with it are one, acne problems that you suffered, and the other is sexual confidence. And I thought that it was interesting that religion or the lack of it or the guilt and fear caused by it would coincide with those two parts of your life. Can I ask you something about acne?
Sure.
To me, this is like the classic kind of thing where you'd really start thinking about Job, you know? Like,
right, exactly.
Why am I stuck with this?
Boils,
what is the meaning of this?
Yeah. And I think for an adolescent at that time, that very tender time, and to be struck with this, and you feel like this is yourself, this is the way the world sees you, this is not something wrong with your leg, your face, that's who you are, it's your identity.
Especially if you're really a reader, which you were,
right.
If you're a young intellectual and you really are very caught up in your mind.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So, no, I found it, and it always got me that people always joke about it, maybe because they're so nervous about it, but that it was, you know, very painful. And I thought, well, you know, why is this happening to me? What is this, what terrible thing has caused this? And what, it was a real crisis. It really was.
Was it a crisis of faith even when you were young?
It was. I mean, it didn't make me not believe, but it made me question everything. It made me question all kind of parts of my life. And it may have been, I read Job. I knew what that was all about. And I thought, well, what does that mean? You know, why are these things happening?
Did you come up with any good interpretation of Job?
Not as good as Carl Jung, and he didn't do very well either. So.
Yeah, another thing was the church and kind of sexual issues. Mm. Did the church scare you at all about sex?
At that point, this is like high school and the 1940s, everything scared me about sex. And as I look back, I think I was right to be scared. I mean, you know, I mean, our sexual class in high school was a class called Health and Safety. And sex took one day in which they passed around pictures of people in advanced stages of syphilis. That was the sexual education. I then went to, in Columbia, this great center of intellectual enlightenment in the 1950s, had a similar class in which the teacher warned us not to read the New York Times Sunday magazine because of the lingerie ads. I mean, this is wild. This is so, yeah, I mean, I think I was right to be scared about the way this culture treated sex at that time was really bizarre.
Did the way the church treated sex have anything to do with your leaving for so long?
I guess I associated that, but I don't think that's when really, at least it wasn't a one-to-one kind of thing. I just associated it with the general thing, you know, the general atmosphere or attitudes about it, about guilt and immorality of that particular kind or the way it was being taught.
And about the same time that you stopped going to church, you also started seeing a psychiatrist, a Freudian psychiatrist. And you had a terrible experience with that doctor. He basically wanted to take control of your life. He told you not to marry the woman you wanted to marry until he was through with the therapy and you really understood
who
you
were.
Well,
but he was not doing anything different than was the creed or is of those, I think, a lot fewer practice, but really strict Freudian psychoanalysis, which, and again, I want to make clear, I'm not talking about psychotherapy or things that I was later helped by and many people were. But that this kind of process where you lay on a couch and the doctor sat behind you and all he said was, yes, go on, so it was just kind of free association, was really dangerous. And I think I was very lucky to get out of it alive and sane.
Do you think you were substituting one authority figure for another in a way?
Maybe so, because I think, you know, I've heard a lot of people say, oh, well, people become religious because they want to give up responsibility. But I gave up responsibility when I went into analysis. I really said, oh, this is going to take it. This is the answer to everything. Therefore, I don't have to worry about anything. I'll wait till that great moment when I'm cured and I'm whole and I'm this perfect person, and then I'll deal with all those things. And I think a lot of people may, of course, you can use anything like that as an escape or of responsibility. But I certainly used analysis that way.
When you started writing novels, how did the issues that you faced coming of age figure into the novel? It seems to me like going all the way, for instance, your first novel has some autobiographical stuff in it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I definitely used that. And I felt that, you know, at Columbia, I had a wonderful professor. In fact, that's why I went to Columbia, named Mark Van Doren, who was a poet. And I remember him saying, you know, whenever you write what is really true for you, the thing that's most embarrassing and most painful, then it's going to be true for a whole lot of other people. And that's what I've always found as a writer. And that was true in the novels. It was true. It's true, I think, with this material also. And it's sometimes hard to really believe that. But whenever you do, you get the response.
Dan Wakefield is my guest, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, Returning, A Spiritual Journey. I want to quote something you said, and this dates back to when you were in college in New York at Columbia, and you wrote, I suddenly feared that if I didn't take some kind of immediate and drastic action, I might become one of those gray, listless people to whom nothing interesting ever happened. And I thought, how many of us go through that, of thinking that you have to ensure somehow that you're going to lead an interesting life. Yeah. What did an interesting life mean to you at that
time? Well, I had real specific things in mind, and that particular thing was that what led me to go to Israel, which was a great experience. And I wanted, at the time that I was having those thoughts, I was working on a weekly newspaper in the small town, and I thought, oh boy, this is not what I want to do. And I had idols like John Reed and Arthur Kessler and journalists who went all over the world, and Hemingway is an idol. And I thought part of my experience as a writer is to experience these things and to, in fact, from Hemingway, I thought part of my experience was to experience what death was like, see people. I thought I have to be in a war. I wanted to be shot at so I would know what that felt like. And I fulfilled that dream. I don't know if it made me a better writer, but at any rate, it added to my experience. But I must say, I look back, I'm really pleased that I did all those things. I mean, I did have a lot of great experiences, and I'm sure that also, I think it has nothing to do with being a good writer. Carson McCullers sat in her living room and wrote The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, which probably tells us more about life than anything 98% of anybody else has written. So
now that you're older, what do you want from an interesting life? What does that expression mean to you now?
What I think I most value now is clarity. And I think that for so much of my life, I was numbing myself with alcohol and sometimes with drugs. And I think, by the way, I don't think people mostly or extensively use drugs and alcohol for kicks, but just to blot things out. And now that in about the last 7 years, I'm not doing that, and then I'm finding all these incredible kinds of experience, and just like in a way in writing this book, to go back and in a way re-experience things with that sense of clarity, and it's just been fabulous, and that's been very exciting.
I just have to ask you, in reference to the alcohol that you used to drink so much of, you used to drink cheap jug wine.
Well, I wasn't rich.
Well, I thought you could afford something just a little bit tastier.
Well, I also had, yeah, I did. What can I say? I just wanted something that was going to, it was like, I was using it like fuel, you know. I might as well have gallons of gasoline, you know, why waste anything good?
Now that you're, you know, you're exercising, you're really fit, you're probably healthier than you've ever been,
yes.
Right? And you've returned to the church, and that's really rejuvenated you in a lot of ways. Do you want to write different kinds of books? I mean, do you see your fiction heading in a different direction now?
I don't want to write different kind of books. I think that I feel a kind of clarity that I hope translates into the writing that I do. And it's real interesting because I have been for a long time wanting to write a novel about New York in the 50s and when I was there, and young people like myself going from the Midwest to New York. And I still want to write that. And I think that maybe the reason I postponed it all this time is that I feel like I can do it in a fuller way now. And one thing interesting is that originally when I thought about it, I wasn't thinking anything about religion or spirituality. But the epigraph I always wanted to use was from the Arch over Washington Square, which is a quote from George Washington that says, "Let us raise a standard to which the wise and the honest can repair. The event is in the hands of God." So now I'll sort of see that in a fuller way, I think.
Oh, you know, just one last thing before we run out of time. You kind of return to religion on your own terms.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And is that what made it possible to do that? You know, you're an adult. You're choosing which church you're going to go to. You're looking for things that are going to suit.
Well,
needs.
I don't think altogether on my own terms. And I want to say also that it's always not easy either. Mm-hmm. And the reason I use the term returning is because I think it's a constant process. It's not something, I certainly wasn't born again. I didn't have a zap of lightning out of the sky. And it takes discipline and constant, a lot of things you don't want to do and that aren't easy to do and that you wouldn't choose maybe to do. So that's part of that, part of the process. And it's challenging all the time too, which also makes it interesting.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Thank you so much for being
here. Thank you.
My guest has been writer Dan Wakefield, and we've been discussing his new spiritual autobiography, which is titled Returning, A Spiritual Journey. It's just been published by Doubleday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with independent record producer Oren Keepnews. He overcame many jazz musicians' perception of the producer as enemy and went on to produce some of the best modern jazz recordings available. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Louis Jordan, the man who created the rhythm and blues sound and foreshadowed rap music. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Fifth Child, the new novel by Doris Lessing. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. In Israel, Arabs staged a general strike in the occupied territory. Riots took place in several villages and refugee camps. NPR's Jim Letterman reports from Jerusalem.
Two large areas of the West Bank were declared closed military zones today after Palestinians once again pelted Israeli soldiers with rocks, and the Israelis responded with tear gas, rubber bullets, and live fire. But the Israeli troops were not just preoccupied with Palestinian strikes and violence. They are now having increasing trouble dealing with Jewish settlers taking the law into their own hands. Last night, the tires of eight Arab cars were slashed in an Arab suburb of Jerusalem. And today, for the first time, Jewish settlers blocked one of the main roads in the West Bank and began to pelt cars owned by Arabs with rocks. Spokesmen for the settlers warned that they will continue to react in this way if cars owned by Jews continue to be attacked by stones and Molotov cocktails. According to the settlers, in Hebron alone last night, the windows of nine Israeli cars were shattered by Palestinian stone throwers. In Jerusalem, I'm Jim Letterman.
Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir and Secretary of State George Shultz continued their discussions about the conflict in the Middle East today, but they were unable to bridge their differences over a U.S. plan for peace in the region. Shamir has rejected U.S. proposals that Israel give up territory for peace. Despite the deadlock, President Reagan reassured American Jews today that the differences do not diminish U.S. support for the State of Israel.
Strategic cooperation, something other administrations shied away from, is now a commitment our two governments have made to each other. It responds to our mutual needs and is a reminder to all that no wedge will be driven between the United States and Israel.
Shamir will be in Washington until Wednesday for talks with other top administration officials. There were two executions today in the U.S. A Vietnam veteran was put to death in Louisiana for the murder of a policeman. Wayne Robert Feldy admitted his crime, but in Florida, Willie Jasper Darden spent 15 years on death row, and as NPR's Joe Maglino reports, he proclaimed his innocence until the moment of execution.
As the sun came up this morning, a small group of Darden supporters stood outside the gates of the prison where they waited for word that he was dead. Darden had been convicted almost 15 years ago of the murder of a Lakeland, Florida storekeeper. Throughout his time in prison, Darden maintained he was innocent. This morning, just moments before he was put to death, he again insisted he did not commit the crime. He read a statement to those witnessing his execution. Warren Elliott, Tampa TV reporter, was one of them.
I ask each of you, ladies and gentlemen, and he looked at each of us with strong eye contact. Search your hearts. Ask yourself not whether you believe in capital punishment, but whether you believe in injustice. My fight has not been against capital punishment, but against the injustice that sent me here.
Human rights activists say they will protest Darden's execution tomorrow at the Florida Capitol. In Tallahassee, this is Joe Maglino reporting.
President Reagan today urged South Africa to grant clemency to six blacks condemned to hang on Friday. The five men and a woman, known as the Sharpeville Six, were convicted of complicity in the 1984 mob killing of a black township official. There has been no reaction from the Pretoria government to the president's appeal for mercy. South Africa has rejected all previous clemency requests. The grand jury in the criminal investigation of Attorney General Edwin Meese today heard from a former National Security Council staff member. Roger Robinson is the second former NSC staffer in 2 weeks to appear before the panel. The investigation centers on Meese's role in efforts to win support for a $1 billion Iraqi pipeline deal in 1985. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 2 points to close at 2047.41. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of one of the many intriguing chapters in the career of rhythm and blues innovator Louis Jordan. Jordan died in 1975 at the age of 66. But before he died, he had recorded duets with Bing Crosby, played to sold-out houses on Broadway, and planted the seeds for a new kind of pop singing.
There are an awful lot of things you can credit Louis Jordan with. By taking standard blues techniques and grafting them onto a small band sound, he pretty much single-handedly invented rhythm and blues, for instance. By recording catchy, funny songs that sold not only to black people, but to an impressive number of whites, he was one of the very first crossover artists. And by making short movies in which he and his band, the Timpani Five, acted out his songs, he was a forerunner of the music video. His career stretched from the 30s to the 50s and was profoundly influential on performers from Chuck Berry to Asleep at the Wheel. But I think one thing nobody's ever mentioned is that Louis Jordan was a pioneer of rap music.
Now if you ever been down to New Orleans, then you can understand just what I mean. Now all through the week it's quiet as a mouse, but on Saturday night they go from house to house. You don't have to pay the usual admission if you're a cook or a waiter or a good musician. So if you happen to be just passing by, stop in at the Saturday night fish fry. It was rockin'. It was rockin'. You never seen such scufflin' and shufflin' till the break of dawn. It was rockin'. It was rockin'. You never seen such scufflin' and shufflin' till the break of dawn.
Jordan recorded all kinds of stuff, from ballads to instrumentals, but it was his fast-moving novelty numbers like Saturday Night Fish Fry that won him the most fame. Like many rappers, he half-talked, half-sung the story of a party that wound up in a raid. His band took care of singing the short chorus. It was a long record, almost 5 minutes long, which was a lot for 1949, but it wound up as a significant pop hit as well as topping the Black Hit Parade. But there were other records that sound even more contemporary and which weren't as popular with white fans. Here's some of his advice in Beware.
Now, fellas, just you fellas, listen to me. Got something to tell you. I want you to listen to every word and govern yourself accordingly. Now pay attention. You see these girls with these fine diamonds and fox furs and fine clothes? Well, Jack, they're looking for a husband. And you're listening to a man that knows.
They ain't hooking.
They ain't fooling. And if you fool around with them, you're gonna get yourself a schooling. If she saves your dough and won't go to a show,
beware, brother, beware.
And if she's easy to kiss and never resists, be careful.
Beware, brother,
be careful.
Beware.
And if you go for a walk and she just listens while you talk,
look out.
She's trying to hook you. And if nobody's looking and she asks you to taste her cooking,
don't do it.
And if you go to a show and she wants to sit in the back row,
bring her down front.
Bring her right down front. And if you go for a snack and she wants a booth in the back, watch her. She's trying to hook you. And listen, if she's used to...
By the way, ladies, there's a companion record called Look Out, Sister, Look Out, in which he evens the score by telling you how to avoid being taken advantage of by a cad. He also made a movie by that name that's a classic of silliness. Now, any good folklorist will tell you that what Jordan was doing wasn't new either. The rhythmic recitation is a big part of black folk life, and it shows up in two prominent places. One is church.
One thing about friends, as long as you're up, you can always find a friend. As long as you have some money in your pocket, you can always find a friend. As long as you have some clothes to give somebody, you can always find a friend. As long as you have food on the table, you can always find a friend. But when you get down and out, a good friend is so hard to find. Only the strong, only the strong, only the strong shall survive.
That's the Reverend Samuel Butler, a fairly modern example of the sort of preacher epitomized by the Reverend C.L. Franklin, Aretha's dad. The other place you'll find the roots of rap are in black fraternal organizations, lodges, and anywhere black men gather together to present what are called toasts. These toasts are long, rhymed, rhythmic, and almost always quite obscene, which is why I'm not playing you a classic like the Titanic or Signifying Monkey. Toasts are where the sexual braggadocio, the macho posturing of rap, comes from. And because folklorists have found pieces of West African tales surviving in them, they're thought to be ancient, predating the arrival of the first slaves on this continent. Once again, though, Louis Jordan led the way by cleaning up a toast and recording it. And once again, this record, Beans and Cornbread, sold to a mostly black audience.
Beans and Cornbread had a fight. Beans knocked Cornbread out of sight.
Beans.
Cornbread said, now that's all right.
Beans.
Meet me on the corner tomorrow night.
I'll be ready. I'll be ready tomorrow night. I'll be ready. I'll be ready tomorrow night. I'll be ready. I'll be ready tomorrow night.
That's what Beans said to Cornbread.
I'll be ready tomorrow night.
Beans told Cornbread, you ain't straight.
Beans.
You better wake up or I'll gas you gate.
Beans.
Been in this pot since 2:30.
Beans.
Swelling and puffing and almost due.
I'll be ready. I'll be ready tomorrow night.
Beans. That's what Beans told Cornbread.
Beans.
Always get mad at me.
Beans.
I ain't mad at you.
Cornbread.
I'll be ready tomorrow night.
Beans.
I'll be ready. Grab Cornbread by the toe.
Beans.
Beans said, Cornbread, let me go.
Beans.
Cornbread said, I'll lay you low.
Beans.
I'm gonna fight you, you so-and-so.
Meet me on the corner. Meet me on the corner tomorrow night.
That's what Beans said, Cornbread. You're so bad, you always wanna fight.
Meet
me on the corner tomorrow night. And I'm gonna beat the devil out of you.
That particular fight ends with Beans and Cornbread realizing that they shouldn't fight because they go so well together. It's fascinating to meditate on just what Louis Jordan would have done with the concept of two turntables, loaded maybe with some Count Basie records or maybe some of his own instrumentals, and a digital sampler for him to rap over. I'm sure he would have come up with something witty, sly, and observant, qualities that only the very best of today's rappers seem to know.
Ed Ward will have more on Louis Jordan in the coming weeks.
Beans and Cornbread. Beans and Cornbread.
This is Fresh Air.
Selection 6, take 1.
This outtake from a 1957 session with Thelonious Monk is included on the new box set, Thelonious Monk, The Complete Riverside Recordings. It just won 2 Grammys for producer Oren Keepnews, Best Historical Album and Best Liner Notes. Keepnews is one of the most respected record producers of contemporary jazz. He founded 2 of the most important independent jazz labels, Riverside and Milestone. And he recorded seminal work by musicians such as Bill Evans, Sonny Rollins, Wes Montgomery, and Cannonball Adderley. Keepnews produced Thelonious Monk's most important body of work.
We're not making one. Oh, you want to make one? Oh, we want to make it. Yeah, okay, we'll make it now. Yeah, make it. Okay.
You know, I bet in putting this box together that there were many sessions that at the time seemed kind of disastrous, but looking at it now, historically, they're fascinating.
I think you've hit on one of the most intriguing aspects of this kind of compilation, as far as I'm concerned. Material that you would not think of attempting to do anything with in its normal state does take on a good deal of fascination and value when put in a historical context. So when you're doing a complete recordings of, you have a great deal of latitude. There were specific unissued chunks of material which makes sense in the context of an overall retrospective, which is exactly what this is, of Thelonious's work at the time.
When you worked with Monk, you were a young producer working with one of the most brilliant and one of the most eccentric musicians in the whole history of jazz. What was he like to record? How did his eccentricities express themselves in the recording studio?
Well, first of all, calling me a young producer is really giving me the best of it. I was an absolutely naive childish, inexperienced producer back then, so that I look back on those sessions and the difficulties of this man as being the most important learning experience in my career. He was difficult for a number of reasons, but I think the most important reason that he was difficult is this was a sort of completely self-contained man. He knew exactly what he wanted out of his music, and he was every bit as demanding of other people, the other musicians and myself, as he was of himself. And that was very unfair, because he knew what it was all about, and we really didn't. We had to kind of catch on this express train as it went roaring by. He was never a patient man, and I think he legitimately did not understand that it was difficult for other people to appreciate and understand his music, and difficult even for very talented musicians to perform it to his satisfaction very quickly.
In your liner notes, you write that working on behalf of an artist doesn't mean you have to be a doormat. You know, that working with an artist and trying to be, you know, on their side doesn't mean you just, like, put up with anything. What gave you that realization?
Well, I guess that realization was spurred by these early encounters with Thelonious. And I recall one specific situation where it was the first time, the first of two separate occasions that I did a totally solo album with him, just a solo piano album. And he showed up for a session close to an hour late and really in no condition to go to work. And I somehow or other lost my temper, informed him that I really didn't care whether or not he had respect for me, but I had to have respect for me, and that in the future, anybody can have, say, 15 minutes or so of leeway, but if he wasn't going to be there within a half an hour of the appointed time, don't bother to show up because I wouldn't be there. We rescheduled this date for a few days later. I got there about 10 or 15 minutes early, and he was sitting in the control room waiting for me and with a beautiful big smile, which he was quite capable of. He said, what kept you?
Was that a turning point in your relationship with him?
I think so. I think, not that I, in no way was this deliberate, but I, when I eventually stood up there and said, hey, you know, I'm a human being too, and get off my back and things like that, it worked. And we had for the next several years, I think, had a very good and I think obviously very creative and to me very satisfying working relationship.
Over the years, how has your idea of what a producer does changed?
Well, I don't know that it actually has fundamentally changed. Again, because I probably learned my lesson so well at the hands of a master, Thelonious, but I, from the beginning, conceived of the role of the producer as being a catalytic agent, and feeling that my job was to create the circumstances, set the scene in such a way that the artist could behave at his creative best. And although my methods of accomplishing that or my techniques of doing it have undoubtedly changed and developed and become more flexible over the years, that concept, I guess, as I look back on it, has stayed with me for over 30 years.
In terms of scene setting, I know that some musicians think of the producer as the guy who goes out and buys the bottle for the session.
That's one important function.
Well, did you ever object to that if musicians wanted a drink during a recording session? Or would you like monitor to see, well, are they getting too high to perform well?
Well, let me put it this way. That is part of what I mean when I say that no two artists can be approached in exactly the same way, probably not even any two sessions with the same artist. You have to be able to evaluate the situation and go with it. I mean, I would find it about as foolish to have a ironclad no drinking on my dates rule as I would to have a, you know, no blues rule or a no electric piano rule or I believe in flexibility, and flexibility is very much a matter of how you deal with people and how you expect them to deal with you.
In your liner notes for the Thelonious Monk box set, you say that you really learned that musicians saw both record companies and record producers as the enemy, or at least the opposition. I'm going to ask you to briefly explain why so many musicians feel that way about record producers and what you tried to do to prove that you didn't want to be the enemy or the opposition.
Well, I guess it's a complex thing in the sense that, I guess obviously to some extent I was talking about a racial situation. Most jazz musicians are black. Most record company executives and producers are white. That should be reasonably self-explanatory as an initial attitude. I've always felt that I've lived in a musical world, in an environment that basically properly belongs to the black artist, that I have to prove my way in that world. And I also think that it was a matter of the, you know, the employer and employee relationship, which comes into the picture. These are things that I tried to break down.
Having worked at independent companies and run your own, what do you think is the difference between the role of the independent jazz company and the larger, more commercial jazz company?
Well, jazz could not have survived if it were not for the independent labels. That the kind of freedom from excessive commercial demands and the kind of one-on-one personal relationship that can exist between the company or the producer and the artist is only possible at the independent level. And jazz needs that kind of personal relationship in order to survive and expand and thrive.
Orrin Keep News currently produces for his label Landmark Records. Here's another Thelonious Monk recording included on the Complete Riverside Recordings. Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
You featuring part two of Dan's Wordling's story on the exploding television?
That's right. Danny investigated lots of evidence pointing to defects in certain models of Zenith television sets. And today he'll be examining further that evidence, which suggests that Zenith had some defects in key components that led to explosions.
What about today's news?
Well, we're following the vote in Illinois. This is the date of the Republican and Democratic presidential primaries in Illinois. Also, more news from the occupied territories where Israel has clamped down again.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Book critic John Leonard has a review of The Fifth Child, a new novel by Doris Lessing. He says once again, Lessing has hit a nerve about contemporary life.
Doris Lessing has seen the 20th century and it doesn't work. As a matter of fact, she's seen through the century, all the way to the other side of civilization, where there's evil. Like Martha in her Children of Violence series, Lessing's always on a quest. In novel after novel, she's wrestled with colonialism, imperialism, Marxism, feminism, terrorism, Freudian analysis, and the radical therapies of R.D. Lang. For a while, she lingered among the Sufis, a mystic business dismaying those of us who counted on her tough-mindedness to see us past the disappointments of history and intimacy. She took time out, perversely and without our permission, to write a 5-volume science fiction space opera, Canopus in Argos. She's back now with a short and stunning dispatch from the Zone of Dread, a novel on which the imagination impales itself, as if on a spear or a sword. In The Fifth Child, David, an architect, and Harriet, a graphics designer, meet in swinging London in the greedy and selfish 60s, and immediately marry, against the tide of the zeitgeist, precisely because they're both squares who insist on being conventionally happy. They want a huge Victorian house in the suburbs with lots of children, in-laws, and pets. And for a while, that's exactly what they get. Then the fifth child, Ben, is born. Ben isn't normal. It's not that he's afflicted with a TV movie disease of the month to live cute and die young. Ben isn't cute, nor innocent. He's an ambassador from some brutish elsewhere. Even in Harriet's womb, he was the enemy. Born stiff and heavy, with a sloping forehead and a hunched look, he's always in a howling rage. Neanderthal baby, Harriet calls him. As a little boy, he strangles dogs and cats, and his brothers and sisters lock their doors at night against him. He is a troll, a goblin, an alien, or throwback, and he won't be loved, not by doctors, teachers, his father, or the reader. Not even by Harriet, his mother. But because this is a Doris Lessing novel, Harriet will accept the awful responsibility of him. She'll care for him, even if it destroys her family, which it does. One day, Ben just leaves, oddly welcome to join the bloodthirsty children of the streets, the bikers and rioters and rapists, the hostile tribes at the gates of the burning city. Bad luck or bad genes, says David. Punishment, thinks Harriet, for thinking we could be happy. The reader is likely to suspect otherwise. I do, anyway. Ben in his brown shirt seems to me a lot like Oscar in The Tin Drum, the sort of Nazi prototype good liberals can't handle, can't even imagine. Or a ferocious beast of the unconscious, a seething libidinal neediness, a nightmare image of the repressed. He might even be everything that's unknowable about naked apes at our worst, from which law, religion, and literature were supposed to protect us, a demiurge or deity of destruction from Hindu myth, some primal death wish. Doris Lessing refuses to explain. From matter-of-fact plain-spokenness, out of a prose as rude as the planks of wood that make the cross on which we nail our gods, she imagines the unspeakable other. You'll find yourself afraid to look in the eyes of your own children.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed The Fifth Child by Doris Lessing. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll speak with Bill Buford, editor of Granta, a British literary magazine staking out new territory in America. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review the recent work of conductor Geoffrey Tate, including a new album in which he leads the English Chamber Orchestra through military and drum roll symphonies. And humorist Alice Kahn will reflect on the difficulty of returning home. So I hope you can join us. We'd like to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, WJHU, in Baltimore, Maryland. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Lisa Bruton directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.